We'll be doing three different selections from Kurt Weill's last work, Lost in the Stars, which is based on the novel Cry the Beloved Country by Alan Paton. The play was written by Maxwell Anderson, and the lyrics were also by Maxwell Anderson. And these three selections are all sung by the leading character of the play, Stephen Kumalo, who is a preacher in a poor community in South Africa. And the first song is called The Little Grey House, where he sings to his nephew about this wonderful place that he has left, his home. Although it's very poor, it's very special because it's home.
There's a little grey house in a one-street town, and the door stands open, and the steps run down, and you prop up a window with a stick on the sill, and you carry spring water from the bottom of the hill. And the white star of Bethlehem grows in my yard, and I can't really describe it, but I'm trying hard. It's not much to tell about, it's not much to picture out, and the only thing special is it's home. It's not much to sing about, it's not much to picture out, and the only thing special is it's home. It's a long road, God knows, a long and turning iron road that leads to Indochine. How I came, God knows, by with ridges, streams, and valleys, and how we shall return is in God's keeping. Many bright days, many dark nights, we must ride on iron before we see that house again. There's a lamp in the room, and it lights the face of the one who waits there in a quiet place, with her hands always busy over needle and thread, or the fire in the kitchen to bake tomorrow's bread. And she'll always have love enough to take you in, and her house will rest you wherever you've been. It's not much to tell about, it's not much to picture out, and the only thing special is it's home. It's not much to sing about, it's not much to picture out, and the only thing special is it's home.
Now the next selection is the title song, Lost in the Stars, which is sung by the preacher Stephen Kumalo in despair when he finds out that his son, his only son, whom he loved very much and sent to Johannesburg, South Africa, for a better education, but who instead has gotten into bad company and has been arrested for the murder of a white man. And Stephen Kumalo sings this song in despair, having lost his faith.
And they ran through his fingers like grains of sand. But one little star fell alone. Then the Lord God hunted through the wide night air for that little dark star on the wind down there. And he stayed and promised he takes special care so it wouldn't get lost again. Now a man don't mind if the stars grow dim and the clouds blow over and darken him, as long as the Lord God's watching over them, keeping track how it all goes on. But I've been walking through the night and the day till my eyes get weary and my head turns gray. And sometimes it seems maybe God's gone away, forgetting the promise that we heard him say. And we're lost out here in the stars, little stars, big stars, blowing through the night. And we're lost out here in the stars, little stars, big stars, blowing through the night. And we're lost out here in the stars, the stars.
The last selection is a soliloquy, we can almost call it an aria, by Stephen Kumalo when he decides to see the father of the young man his son has killed and ask him for forgiveness.
Come to here at this crossing of paths. Must he tell a lie and live, or speak truth and die? And if this is so, what can I say to my son? O Tico, Tico, help me. I have come to him and said, speak truly, evade nothing, what you have done, let it be on your head. And he heeded me not at all. Like rain, he ran through my hands, concealing as a boy will, taking what was not his, evading commands. For he seemed to hear none of my words. Turning, shifting, he ran through a tangle of night and days, till he was lost to my sight. And went far into evil and evil ways, and he was stricken and rocked back, and he loved, and he was desperate with love and fear and anger, and at last he came to this. O God of the humble and broken, O God of those who have nothing, 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 to this, to the death of a man. I shall keep my father's ways and remember them. And can I go to him now and say, my son, take care? Tell no truth in this court, lest go ill with you here. Keep to the rules, beware. Some other hope. My son did not mean to kill his son. He did not mean to kill. Oh, Tycho, Tycho, help me. What can I do? To whom can I appeal? Oh, Tycho, Tycho, help me. Where can I turn now? Oh, Tycho, Tycho, help me.
How did you first meet Kurt Weill in Mauritania?
I auditioned for Kurt Weill as a rehearsal pianist. He was doing a show called Firebrand of Florence, and I was a friend of the conductor, Maurice Abravanel, whom you probably know, who conducted that show, and I was interested in getting experience in the theater. And when he told me that he was conducting a show of Kurt Weill, and they needed a rehearsal pianist, would I like to audition for that? I was beside myself, because I had just come from Germany, where the name Kurt Weill was very, very special to me. I'd grown up with his music, Threepenny Opera and Mahagoni, and never dreamt that someday I would meet him. So I went to audition for the show, which meant that I had to play for the auditions. I had to accompany the singers who were auditioning for the show. And they wanted to see how well I could sight read, et cetera, and how I was playing and adjusting to various things that happen when you do these kind of auditions. And I did that for 3 days. And at the end of it, I was hired as rehearsal pianist.
Was that the first time you met Lenya also, or had you known him
Yes,
before?
I met Weil first, but Lenya had a leading role in that particular show. And so when we started to rehearse, then I met her, of course.
What were your first impressions of her voice?
Well, I couldn't say first impressions because I grew up with that voice, you see. I was totally familiar with her voice from the recordings in Germany, of her recordings of Three Penny Opera and Mahogany. So her voice was absolutely no surprise to me at all. I knew her work very well by that time. Of course, I had never heard her sing in English. She sang in English in that particular show.
Before we talk a little more about Lari Lenya, since you first came to know them both through the Firebrand of Florence, and that's how you became the rehearsal pianist for Kurt Weill, let's listen to a song from it that you told me was written for Lari Lenya.
Right, right.
And this was a collaboration between Weill and lyricist Ira Gershwin, which
right.
I've always thought was a very unusual combination.
Well, I guess it was. Well, you know, after George Gershwin died, Ira never wanted to write lyrics again for anybody. And I believe, I'm pretty sure that's correct, that Weill was the first composer he ever worked again after his brother's death. And they became great friends, Weill and Ira Gershwin, because Kurt Weill was a great admirer of George Gershwin. And George Gershwin, whom he met personally, as a matter of fact, when the Weills, both, Lotte Lenya and Weill, came to this country, they both saw Porgy and Bess as one of the first things they saw, which at that time was running on Broadway. And Weill was tremendously impressed by that and said at that time, that's the kind of opera I would like to write in America, and which he eventually did in Street Scene. And he had met both Gershwin socially and had great admiration for both of them.
Well, there's a recording that was, I think, a rehearsal recording.
Audition. It was an audition.
Well, this is, we'll hear Kurt Weill at the piano and,
right.
and Ira Gershwin singing. How
right.
was the record used?
It wasn't, they were, at that time, you know, they had to audition for sponsors. They were looking for angels to finance the show. And composer and pianist, as they still do today, they played the songs for future angels and recorded it, you know. And that's how this tape came about.
Well,
it's a tape now. Then it was recording.
Let's hear their tape of Sing Me Not a Ballad, and then we'll talk a little bit about Lari Lenya's recording of it and hear her sing it.
Make way for the Duchess, for her grace the Duchess. Make way for the Duchess, for the regal, legal Duchess. Chorus of the Duchess song. Sing me not a ballad, send me not a sonnet. I require no ballad, rhyme and time are wasted on it. Save your books and flowers, not necessary. Oh, the precious hours lost in grim preliminaries. Deck me not in jewels, sigh me not your sighs, duel me no duels, and please don't vocalize. Romance me no romances, treasure not my glove, spare me your advances, just oh just make love, spare me your advances, just oh just make love.
We heard Ira Gershwin singing his own lyrics, Kurt Weill playing his music from the Firebrand of Florence that was Sing Me Not a Ballad. My guest is Lise Simonette, And you were saying that the song was written for Larilena.
Right.
What is it about the song that you think is right for her voice?
Well, what do you mean, vocally or lyrically? As far as the lyrics are concerned or the music is concerned?
The music.
The music, well, it's right for her voice. I mean, it's one of those slightly ironic tunes with a little sarcasm in, for which she had such special talent. And in this particular show, she was playing the Duchess of Medici, who was having an affair with Benvenuto Cellini. And so Cellini was ardently trying to, woo her. And she sings this song to him, says, "Sing me not a ballad, just make love," you know. And it sort of fitted her style of slightly tossed away, ironic lyrics. Unfortunately, in the show itself, the show was not well directed at the time. It was actually not a Broadway musical. It was an operetta, an opera comique, if you will. And it was way ahead of its time. And it had an operatic baritone in the lead as Benvenuto Cellini and an operatic ingenue who didn't sing very well. And for the Duke of Medici was originally planned to engage Walter Zlezak, who was a wonderful comedian, who would have made a marvelous pair with Larilena. But he wasn't available, or he was too expensive, I forgot which. And instead, some British comedian, Melville Cooper, who was completely wrong for the Duke of Medici and also as a partner for Lenya. So somehow the whole show, it didn't come off. And it closed after 5 weeks. But now I am sure, with all this interest in Wilde's former works, would be the right time to revive it in an opera house rather than on Broadway.
Why don't we listen to a recording that Larilena made of the song
right.
that we've been discussing and listening to, Sing Me Not a Ballad.
I am not like Circe, who showed men no mercy. Men are most important in my life. Venus, Cleo, Psyche are melodies in my key. They knew how to live the high life. Gallantry I find archaic. Poetry I find prosaic. Give me the man who's strong and silent, inarticulate but violent. Sing me not a ballad, send me not a sonnet. I require no ballad. Rhyme and time are wasted on it. Save your books and flowers. They're not necessary. Oh, the precious hours. Deck me not in jewels, sigh me not your sighs, duel me no duels, and please don't vocalize. Romance me no romances, treasure not my glove, spare me your advances, just or oh, just. Love, spare me your advances, just, oh, just make love. save your books and flowers. They're not necessary. Deck me not in jewels, sigh me not your sighs, duel me no duels, and please don't vocalize. Romance me no romances, treasure not my glove, spare me your advances. Just, oh, just make love. Spare me your advances. Just, oh, just make love. Lottie
Lenya singing Sing Me Not a Ballad with lyrics by Ira Gershwin, music by Kurt Weill. My guest is Lise Simonette, who spent a number of years as the rehearsal pianist for Kurt Weill and who later became the accompanist for Lottie Lenya and was her good friend. And she also teaches now at the Curtis Institute of Music. I've mentioned this before in this program, but growing up with World War II movies and stuff, I always had problems with the German language. It always sounded to me like a war movie about Nazis. And it was listening to singers of Weill's music with German lyrics by Brecht that I began to really appreciate the sound of the German language and the real beauty of it, when particularly in the voice of a good singer. And it was Lottie Lenya's records, I think, that really made me aware of those sounds. And in English, too, she has such beautiful enunciation of the words. Was that natural to her, or did she have to work on that?
Well, first of all, she was born in Vienna, where, to my taste anyway, they speak the most beautiful German. It's a little bit more elegant than the real German. So, and they also, they flip their R's more. It's closer to Italy. And so besides this Viennese upbringing, she studied acting from the age of 14, 15, and took very serious drama lessons. And which is not so known in this country is that she started out as a classical actress. First she served her apprenticeship as ballet girl in the theater of Zurich, the Civic Theater of Zurich. She did ballet and she did operettas. But then she took drama lessons and she really wanted to be a serious actress. And she played Shakespeare. She played Goethe, she played Schiller, she played all the classics, and came to Berlin playing classics as well as modern plays. But which, for modern plays, she's well known, but nobody knows that she's played, you know, Shakespeare and these kind of things. And of course, her speech was beautifully developed this experience.
Did you ever work with her on her singing? Or?
She had a natural voice. She didn't need anybody to help her with her singing. It was a natural talent. The only thing I did is play the accompaniment for her, but she knew exactly what to do. Nobody had to coach her or anything. And the most amazing thing is, which she never made any bones about, she couldn't read a note of music. And she learned it all by ear. And she begged Weill, when they first got married, to give her instructions, you know, how to read music and how to count and all that. And he said, no, I wouldn't think of it because it'll ruin you. And he was so right, because her musical instincts were so perfect. And it's always astounded me, especially when you hear her recording of Mahagoni, where she sings the duet of the two cranes, which is very complicated musically. And she sings it absolutely without any kind of a flaw musically, just by ear, just picked it up.
You said that you grew up with her music in Germany. And
right.
I'm sure that she was very, very popular there. Then she moved to America and had to reestablish her reputation. Did she miss the fame that she had in Germany?
Not at all. When they both arrived in America, Her only consideration was that Kurt Weill should establish himself again. And she was very unusual in that respect of an artist couple, that she always put herself second to his interests. And she was only interested in that make a good home for him, to help him over the very great difficulties facing him with these many, because they went to France first after they left Germany, so he had to adjust to the French scene. And then again, coming to America, he had to adjust to the American scene. And so she was absolutely determined to put his interests before her own. And when she did this one thing, The Firebrand of Florence, which did not turn out to be a success, not because of her fault, was just the whole thing was just one of those things that didn't go right. And after that, she just decided not to do anything at all.
Did that bother you, since she's such an extraordinary talent?
It didn't bother her at all at that time.
Did it bother you, though, as a friend of hers and colleague?
Well, I didn't know her that well when I was that young. You see, I was very much in awe of both of them. And although I became a friend, but it was sort of distant. You know, there was a distance between us because I was so very young at that time. And as I said, terribly in awe of them. The friendship developed between her and myself, developed more after Weill died. And then she needed a little bit more of my help, too, with various musical questions and with the estate, and all was very, very difficult for her. And then we became closer and closer as the years went by.
What kind of material was she? Was she performing much, say, in the after Weill's death?
After Weill's death, she didn't want to perform at all. She was so completely shocked by the sudden death. You know, he was only 50 years old and was only ill for about 2 weeks. And he had a heart attack and just didn't recover from it. And so she was completely shattered by this experience. And she didn't do anything. And about 2 or 3 years after he died, she was asked by the original producer of Threepenny Opera, who had also become a refugee. His name was Ernst Josef Aufrecht, who lived in New York. And he wanted to present Threepenny Opera in concert form in New York, because it hadn't been done in New York, except for once in 1931, where it was a big flop. And very reluctantly, she agreed to appear. And she had gotten married again at that time to a man by the name of George Davis, who was a journalist. He was editor of Harper's Bazaar and Mademoiselle, very brilliant man, a very fine writer. And he was also had been a friend of Weill, and he was very encouraging. And he said, look, if you want to do anything for the music of Kurt Weill, you have to become Lotte Lenya again and not Kurt Weill's widow. And you can do much more for his music then. And sort of this way of thinking inspired her to really go back to work. And she did this appearance in Threepenny Opera. It was a huge success. And then she did it again with Leonard Bernstein. They did it at Brandeis University in Mark Blitzstein's translation. And eventually she did the revival of the Threepenny Opera in Blitzstein's translation at the Theatre de Lys in New York, which became a sensation, and really established Threepenny Opera as one of the masterpieces of 20th century theater. And from that time, and then she made these famous recordings, which you have here, and which sort of suddenly put her on the map again as an interpreter of Weill's music. But besides that, she took in a few other engagements. She starred as Mother Courage in Germany, in German, as in the play by Brecht, without Weill's music. And then, as you know, she made various movies and starred in Cabaret on Broadway.
I must say, I was very surprised and also disappointed to find so little written about her after her death in late 1981. I've always considered her to be a very important singer and a very wonderful singer, and I felt that there wasn't really enough attention.
Well, I don't know. It was on the national news.
And was it? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Maybe I was just in a news blackout that
yeah,
day.
Yeah, and it was a huge... The New York Times carried it on the front page. A huge article about... Yeah.
I guess it's more of my problem then.
Well, I don't know. Maybe in the... She wasn't so well known in outside of New York. She was a real New York celebrity. And... you're probably right, but we intend to have a big exhibit about her in New York sometime this fall. Something will be done on a broader scale.
Good.
That's for sure.
I'm speaking with Lise Simonette, who was for many years a rehearsal pianist for Kurt Weill, accompanist for Lottie Lenya, a good friend of Lottie Lenya's, and now teaches at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Lise, you were one of the people instrumental in the new Teresa Stratus album of newly discovered or previously forgotten Kurt Weill songs. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be hearing a couple of selections from that. Can you tell us a little bit about the putting together of this record and what the idea behind it was?
Well, the idea was that, you know, Teresa Stratus made an enormous, like everything she does, I mean, was extraordinary, an enormous impression as Jenny in the Mahogany revival of the, not revival, the first performance, the Metropolitan did. And she fell in love with, she never had heard anything substantial of Weill's more European works. And she fell in love with the music. And when she was asked to do a concert of all Kurt Weill songs at the Whitney Museum in New York, she was very enthusiastic about it and asked me, you know, to make some suggestions for her of songs that are not so well known. And of course, there is a treasure of Kurt Weill songs which are not well known as yet, like any famous composer. There are always some jewels that haven't come to light yet. So I presented her with a long list of things, and she made her selections and picked out the most wonderful numbers and sang them at the Whitney Museum in New York. And it was such an extraordinary evening. I mean, people were absolutely spellbound because she is really very unique in what she does. Whatever she touches is something extraordinary. And from the success of that concert, there were reverberations, and the record company Nonesuch approached her whether she would do these songs and perhaps some more for them, and she enthusiastically said yes, and that's how the album came about.
Well, we're going to hear two songs that you've suggested make an interesting contrast in the way Kurt Weill, in his politics and in his politics in different periods of his life. The second song we're going to hear is called Schicklgruber, but the first song, which I'd like you to tell us a little bit about, since it will be sung in German, is, and you can help me with my pronunciation on this, Das Lied von den Bronneninseln.
Yeah, well, I mention that because it's so often it's said, and especially in Germany, they feel that Kurt Weill was such a very, how can I say, outspoken social critic, and really satirized circumstances, like as in Threepenny Opera, and attacked political issues in Germany in a very harsh way. Also, sometimes alienated by his very sweet music, but which made it almost more sinister. But very, very strong statements. And it is often said that in America he did not do that anymore, and he became commercial and whatever you want, and romantic. And it's not true. The only thing is that in America he fell in love with this country. He was so grateful of finding refuge here, of finding acceptance here. He loved the newness of the music. He loved jazz. He loved Gershwin. He loved Cole Porter. And he felt there were not anything here in this country that he felt that he wanted to attack violently or harshly. And when he even, this is why I suggested playing the song Schicklgruber, which is about Hitler, and which was written as a wartime effort to help war workers in the factories to spend time. And it was a movement they called Lunchtime Follies, in which he worked with Moss Hart and Gershwin and Oscar Hammerstein and Howard Dietz. A lot of prominent writers gave their talent to help the morale of the war workers. And when he wrote this song about Schicklgruber, about Hitler, although it has very angry lyrics, the music is not as angry as his German music. And I thought that was interesting to note. It's still there, but it is all like, you know, you will not attack somebody who's been good to you as violently.
Let's hear both of these recordings
right.
back to back. The first written in 1928, and then Schicklgruber with lyrics by Howard Dietz, written in 1942.
Oh, I must say something about this Lied von den Braunen Inseln, which is the Song of the Brown Islands. That has to do, and which is quite prophetic in many of the write-ups, it's been said how unusual that at that time oil and its evil effects on human greed was attacked. And this is exactly what this is. It's an attack on the people who go to the islands to dig for oil and become miserable and ill, and the oil stinks, you know. I say it because it's on the record, too. And one guy asked the other, "Are you going there, Freddy?" He said, "Oh, no, not me, Freddy. I'm going to stay. If I want to see monkeys, I go to the zoo." And I just want to give you an idea of that.
Okay,
that's that song.
And that's the song we'll hear first.
Yeah.
Das ist von den braunen Inseln das Lied. Die Männer sind schlecht und die Weiber sind krank. Und eine Effi mag dort den Betrieb und die Felder verdorren im Ölgestank. Gehst hin, Freddy. Ist nicht Teddy, der Dollar allein macht das Herz nicht froh. Gehst hin, Freddy, ist nicht Teddy. Ich will Affen sehen, will ich gehen so. Das sind die braunen Inseln, mein Jung. Die Weiber sind krank und die Männer sind schlecht. Eine Äffin hält dort das Ganze in Schwung. Und wer kommt, ist gesund. Und wer geht, ist geschwächt. Gehst hin, Freddy. Ich nicht, Teddy. Der Dollar allein macht das Herz nicht froh. Gehst hin, Freddy. Ich nicht, Teddy. Ich will Affen sehen, will ich gehen in Zoo. Wer kommt, ist gesund und wer geht, ist geschwächt. Die Äffin regiert in Bett und Fabrik. Die Äffin hat Geld und die Äffin hat Recht. Und das Mannsvolk pariert in Bett und Fabrik. Gehst hin, Freddy. Ich nicht, Teddy. Der Dollar allein macht das Herz nicht froh. Gehst hin, Freddy. Ich nicht, Teddy. Ich, wenn Affen sehen will, ich geh in Zoo. Petroleum stinkt und die Insel stinkt. Sie stinkt nach gelbem und schwarzem Mann. Doch der Dollar stinkt nicht, den das Erdöl bringt. Und gegen die Äffin kann keiner an. Gehst hin, Freddy! Ich nicht, Teddy! Der Dollar allein macht das Herz nicht froh. Gehst hin, Freddy! Ich nicht, Teddy. Ich will Affen sehen, will ich gehen zu. In a hamlet in the Tirol, an old lady isn't virile. She is languishing and heavy is her heart. For she thinks about her baby who had he been christened A.B. Maybe might have never played the monster's part. If her son had only married, if her lust had not miscarried, who can say for certain what might not have been? In her somber weeds of sorrow, she is hopeful some tomorrow will undo the passion that produced the sin. Schicklgruber, Schicklgruber, you were born a child of shame. You have always been a bastard, even though you changed your name. Came the headlines,
Two songs by Kurt Weill, the second with lyrics by Howard Dietz, both sung by Teresa Stratus, the first written in 1928 and the second in 1942. And you were saying, Lise, that the... Why don't you repeat what you were saying when it was on about how the second one isn't as angry as the first?
Although he should be plenty angry at Hitler, but, you know, it's more good-natured. That's the way I feel, you know. The attack is not as vicious as it was in Germany.
Did he have a political falling out with Brecht?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because he... I can describe it very briefly. As Weill said, "I do not wish to compose Das Kapital." That tells the whole story, you know, because he did not agree with Brecht's Marxism.
How did you come to America? Let's talk about you, Lise Manette.
Well, I got a scholarship at the Curtis Institute of Music. And naturally, I wanted to get out of Germany the worst way. I'm Jewish. And I was very young and I wanted to study music. And I was lucky to get this scholarship in this marvelous, marvelous, marvelous school. And I was privileged to know Mrs. Curtis Bach, cymbalist, personally at that time. And they helped me in every way, because I couldn't take any money out of Germany, you know, and I was helped financially, and I got my education. It was great.
You've since working with Weill as his rehearsal pianist and then working with Lenya, of course, you've done a lot of translations from English to German.
Right.
And from German into English.
Right.
Which is a really wonderful transformation, having done it both ways. What are some of the things about German that are hard to get into English and things from English lyrics that are hard to get back into German?
Well, you know, that you have that problem with every language, and translations are always compromises. They're never any good. I mean, even the best ones, they're really pretty poor. And, for instance, Brecht, to translate Brecht into English and being tied down to certain notes and rhythms, it's almost impossible to do justice to it.
In particular, I think some of Brecht's lyrics, for a while, there's a lot of spit in the words.
Right, right.
A real anger that comes across
right.
That spitting sound. Can you get that into English in a translation?
No. I think that the best that I've personally seen is the Mark Blitzstein version of the Threepenny Opera. I mean, for instance, the Mac the Knife is just brilliant. I mean, how he came so close to the original and singable at the same time and very catchy to the ear. I think that was a masterpiece on Mark Blitzstein's part, and probably also because he was a composer, he had even more ability than just an ordinary translator.
Have you traveled to Germany to see the staging of any of the English works that you translated into German?
Oh, yeah, I lived in Germany. My husband is an opera singer, and he sang mostly Wagner, and also Weill, as a matter of fact. I met him in Firebrand of Florence. He was in that. And he recorded quite a bit of Weill, too. But he sang in Germany for 15 years. We lived in Düsseldorf. And so I saw quite a few performances of Wiles worked in Germany. And to take a work like Lost in the Stars, which is very simple, the song that we heard, Little Grey House, which sings wonderfully in English, but you do that in German, in this kind of simplicity, it's very difficult. It sounds corny immediately. So one has to use quite a bit of ingenuity to get around that. I found that very difficult. The simpler the songs and the more romantic, the more difficult they are to do in German.
Some people think of Wiles' Broadway work as being not as interesting as his German period. And some have even said, and I really don't agree with this at all, but some people said that it was almost like a selling out or a commercializing of his music. Do you feel that way at all?
I don't feel that way at all, but I mean, especially in Germany, the Germans have a very, very negative attitude toward everything that Weil has written in America. And whether it's a feeling of guilt because, you know, he had to leave because he was Jewish and he had to leave Germany. And even if he hadn't been Jewish, like Brecht was not Jewish, his political beliefs, and that has nothing to do with Brecht's Marxism. This was just because Weil was a true liberal and humanist. And who, you know, anybody who had this kind of attitude toward humanity would not stay long in Nazi Germany. So that he became so successful in America and was so thoroughly able to adjust his musical writings to the popular theater of America, this is something that the Germans still haven't forgiven him for. They would rather he would have just starved or just retain his old way of writing. And he was not that kind of a composer. He was always going forward.
You were a singer, although you can no longer sing. Why did you have to give up singing?
Well, I when I came to Curtis, I was both a voice and a piano major. And I gradually, when I got married to a singer, I gradually sang less and less. And finally, a few years ago, I developed something on my chords, which doctors thought maybe was not such a nice thing. It'd be cut out. And thank God it was not a malignancy, but it's still something left my one vocal cord sort of half paralyzed and I can't sing anymore. But I'm very happy that it's all it was. So, and I just let my students sing now.
Well, I really wish we had a lot more time to talk, but we are unfortunately running out of time, which I deeply regret. Maybe we could talk again sometime. But I'd like to end this program by listening to something that you recorded another Weil Brecht collaboration, and this is called Der Jazzsänger. Did I get that right? No.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I'm not familiar with this work at all, and I bet a lot of our listeners aren't.
That's one of his best. Really a marvelous work.
Is this album still available?
I think it's sort of become a classic. It's being reprinted constantly.
Well, we're going to hear you singing from the album of this work. Would you just introduce us to it, help place us in it?
Play Der Jahrsager, the Yes-Sayer, is a play that Brecht adapted from the Japanese. It's a legend about a young boy whose mother is very ill, and the only way he can get a remedy to cure her is if he makes a perilous journey across the mountains with his teacher. And he's willing to take the journey, although he is being warned that if he's too weak to survive the journey, they'll have to leave him by the wayside and just kill him, you know, because they will not hold up their trip for his sake. And he agrees to do so, and he says yes, the Jahrsager. And surely enough, the trip is too rough, the journey is too rough. He gets ill. They throw him down a rock, and the journey goes on. And that's the story. And the little aria you hear is an arietta that the mother sings to the boy how much she loves him before he goes away.
Well, before we hear you singing this, Lise Simonette, I want to thank you enormously for talking with us and for playing a little earlier. It's really been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm always very happy that any opportunity I have to speak about Lenya and Weil, I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
Ich habe seine Worte.